The markets. We just can't get enough of them.
Markets are the drivers of your wealth and investment strategy.
Welcome to Magic Markets with your co-hosts, the Finance Coast and Mohammed Nalla.
Together, we have more than 25 years of combined experience in the markets.
For those looking to take their market and business knowledge to the next level, we offer Magic Markets Premium. In response to the recent turmoil around tariffs, we've looked at global options like BAE Systems, Lloyds Banking Group, BMW, and Alibaba, as well as US GOAT of investments, Berkshire Hathaway. Visit magic-markets.com today and go premium to get these insights. Welcome to episode 226 of Magic Markets, and we've had a few shows in a row now where I think, Mo, we've done a pretty decent job, I like to think, of covering what's topical in the US market and locally for that matter, and just some of what we're seeing among company news and this whole macroeconomic environment and inflation and all the chaos. We've had some nice feedback from our listeners and we always welcome that, so please do keep that coming. This week we are doing something a bit different because we had quite a cool situation where a listener reached out to us and said, you know, hey guys, cool podcast. I might have some interesting insights to share. And here we are. We have Moafe Kwinde on the podcast, and we'll introduce him shortly. We also have Mo, as usual, all the way from Canada. So Mo, hello, and welcome.
Indeed, Ghost. I mean, I'm just a little nervous because last week we were telling our listeners that if you don't like what we're doing on Magic Markets, you've got to tell us. And then Moafe reached out to us and actually said, hey guys, I'd like to come on the podcast. So I'm hoping Moafe has some kind words for Magic Markets, but that's not really what we're talking about this week. I think, Moafe, your journey has been so interesting, right? Because you're someone who comes with a finance background, you've been an equity analyst, you've worked, you know, the notable kind of dream job in finance. We'll get into some of that shortly. And then you moved, you transitioned from that into a much more entrepreneurial approach. And so there's a lot for us to actually unpack on this week's show because we want to know a bit about that journey. We want to know how you actually get the insights you gleaned from the finance industry to work for you in the kind of more business-oriented entrepreneurial industry. And I'm not going to steal from the thunder because we've got a lot to go through. I think it's a slightly different flavor to what we've done recently on Magic Markets. And again, that's fantastic because we are all about learning from different areas out there in the market, learning from you, from our listeners as well. So Moafe, with that as the background, welcome onto the Magic Markets podcast.
Yeah, thanks, James. Welcome to the listeners and, you know, great to be here. You know, I've been following you guys for a while. Spoke to Ghost, you know, last week and just mentioned how even in my journey as an equity analyst, you know, it was easy to just sort of follow his work and kind of have digestible insights into real life, you know, analysis problems that we had. So thanks.
Thank you. Shame, nothing nice to say about you, Mo. Just me. I got all the love there. Not a single con. I like you, Mo.
We know that you are the brains of the operation, not the looks. That's why we hide you behind a purple ghost. But Moafe, let's jump in.
Play to our strengths. Yeah.
Play to our strengths, right? I've got a face for radio. That's what someone once told me. I'm not going to say who, but Moafe, well, that is the background. I mean, it's not something that a lot of people do often, right? A lot of people get into the finance stream. As I say, they kind of see that as the dream job. Everyone wants to be in finance. Everyone wants to be an equity analyst or a trader. And you went from that into this transition into what we really like to call the real world. And so maybe tell us a little bit about that. Tell us a bit about your background, firstly, as an equity analyst, you know, what you enjoyed, and then what also led you to stop doing that and to actually make this move into entrepreneurship, because both Ghost and I know that move into entrepreneurship is not an easy journey. But let's maybe use that as a starting off point. You know, what was some of your rationale behind the move that you made?
Okay, cool. So just some background. My name is Moafe Kwinde, and I sort of started out as a buy-side analyst. You know, I was deep in the numbers and narratives of the JSE. And I agree, Mo, it's certainly a job that is particularly a dream job for a lot of people in finance. So I'm quite blessed to have found myself in that position. It's a job that, if you have a passion for finance, really helps you unlock that. This is something I particularly enjoyed about equity analysis, is just your ability to continue learning on a daily basis. I tell my wife, it makes you a better person because you know more, you know, but I guess that's up to debate on what makes you a better person, right?
Sounds like a strongly biased view of a finance professional there, but I'm willing to adopt that view as well. We'll go with it, Mo. We are better people because we read annual reports. This is it. We're going to tell our friends. No, I'm kidding. But it is true. Reading widely is part of the job, and it does actually really improve your knowledge of the world around you. It absolutely does. The fact that it's an investment lens is only one part of it.
Correct, yeah. And sorry, just to speak to what I was asking you earlier, ultimately, it was my passion. And I just thought my passion, and I've learned a lot from there. But I kind of found myself in a position where I was trying to build something real, something tangible, you know, something for myself. And I was sort of blessed to be afforded an opportunity in the mining space, which allowed me to sort of transition and become my own entrepreneur. You know, it's been a hell of a journey, you know, because even now as I'm working in the mining space, I have a sort of business that I'm looking to scale up in the industrial hemp space. And I believe my experience as an analyst, and this is why I say it makes you a better person, better investor, has really pushed me or guided me to understand some of the dynamics behind entrepreneurship, you know, taking some of the lessons learned over the years.
No, absolutely. I always think one of the good things you can do in your career is go from writing and reading about working capital to actually living that, understanding what it's like to have cash or not, understanding what it's like to chase debtors, being on the other end as a supplier and waiting to get paid and how annoying that can be, and becoming someone else's working capital pressure. It's just a silly example, but this is the real world, hey? And once you get into it, you get to see the stuff. So I think with that in mind and your particular flavor of what you're doing in the real world, as part of the Quinda Investment Group, which is obviously a nice little investment holding company there as part of what you're doing. But once you dig down below that, then what are you busy with at the moment? You've mentioned mining, you've mentioned a bit of industrial hemp there, which is interesting. So what are you busy doing now?
So basically, as you mentioned, Quinda Investment Group operates as an investment vehicle that houses two businesses in particular. One business is essentially an earth-moving machinery leasing business. So think bulldozers, think front-end loaders, think excavators. I own a small fleet of those that I rent out, or lease out rather, to my clients who export coal and chrome in the Richards Bay port. So, you know, I'm basically trying to help keep the electricity alive around the world, you know, small dents, but I mean, you know. And then on the industrial hemp side, so it's quite a technical business, but essentially we're scaling up a business that is aiming to be Africa's first vertically integrated processor of hemp-based materials. It's a very new industry. I find myself having to teach a lot of the relevant stakeholders and funders essentially what the business is and how it works. And I feel a lot of my clients or prospective clients don't even understand they need it until, you know, we explain it to them, you know. So it's a new realm, interesting realm, but obviously not one without its hurdles.
I mean, I understand the kind of yellow goods leasing. I mean, that's something that's, again, a fantastic niche to operate in if you figure out the right kind of areas to operate in. I know nothing about industrial hemp, so maybe I want to just start off there. Like, tell me, what is industrial hemp? Because, you know, when we think hemp, everyone's kind of thinking weed and cannabis shops, all of this stuff. But industrial hemp, I'm assuming, is completely different. So let's educate us here, because I have absolutely no idea. Speak to me as though I'm like a five-year-old. What is industrial hemp? What's the opportunity set there?
Not completely different, Mo. Not completely different. You're on the right track there.
Yeah, no, so just to sort of get into it, industrial hemp is a crop, an agricultural crop. It comes from the same ancestry as cannabis and has largely been classified as cannabis for many years. So in recent years, the South African government, and even broadly speaking, there's been a move towards the decriminalization of cannabis as well as industrial hemp. And they've actually put in frameworks to separate legally and commercially industrial hemp from cannabis. You know, so right now, cannabis is a medicinal product. For one, it's regulated by SAHPRA, higher regulation, you know, higher red tape, whereas industrial hemp is more of an industrial product, as the name says. It's an agricultural product, it's less, and it's actually regulated by the Department of Land Reform Agriculture, essentially, which falls under a completely different mandate. So, and just to kind of simply put it, you know, you get two main outputs from hemp. Hemp is like a plant. You get two main outputs. You get hemp fiber and you get hemp herd. Think of it like a banana, right? You get the banana peel, which would be the fiber, and you get the actual banana, which is the herd on the inside. And they each have different applications. The key thing about hemp is just its sustainability factor, you know, and kind of how it can look to, especially in our case, as we look to create fiber for textile markets, we want to replace cotton, you know. We found ourselves in a position where we can make it cost competitive. And like I say, you know, Mo, it's kind of hard with a lot of these clients, because you have to teach them, you know, that, hey, this is how you can use hemp in your supply chain. And they kind of come out like, oh, I didn't even know that. Okay, well, now that I know, let's use it, you know, it's not as simple as that, but, you know.
And I mean, just staying on that point, you know, you say you replace cotton. I mean, a lot of supply chains are well developed in the kind of textile industry, into the cotton industry. How does hemp kind of play in that space? I'm assuming it's a fairly new area, so lots of runway. If you're looking to displace cotton as kind of the standard there, that's one question is, you know, how much runway is there really? What percentage of the market's currently using hemp product and what percentage, you know, what's the kind of scope for growth there? The second one is kind of, let's say, a softer question in that, and pardon the pun here, right? What's the tactile experience around hemp? Because in my head, I'm picturing hemp. It's a fiber, but it's not like soft, like cotton. And I know that's a strange question, but I'm sure it's a question you're getting from a lot of the people you're trying to educate along the use of industrial hemp. So what does that look like?
Yeah, so hemp was used historically. It's not really a new industry, but because of the changes in regulation, we consider it new. And hemp is essentially like the fiber. Fiber is hard, right? So raw hemp fiber comes out hard, and it kind of, that's what speaks to the strength of fiber versus cotton. So I don't want to get too technical about it, you know, but hemp has a higher tensile strength than cotton. So it actually makes sense in terms of industrial applications. So think of conveyor belts, you know, conveyor belts are knitted. A conveyor belt is essentially a thick knitted sheet, you know, bunch of sheets knitted upon each other to make a thick layer. And depending on the sort of input material that you use there, it can give you varying strengths. You know, so hemp is one of those input factors that give you higher strength, but more sustainability. So it actually can help us replace cotton. You know, you guys are good looking guys. I mean, you guys have been to places like Zara, H&M, where you can buy nice things, right? You walk into the store and you find they have a green line, a sustainable line, you know, where they're trying to essentially replace cotton. That input material that makes that line green is what we're looking to provide them.
Mo was once GQ's best dressed man, to my great ongoing joy all these years later. So that's why he's asking. But maybe I just don't want to lose that first point Mo made, which is just how far along is hemp in actually displacing cotton in some of these applications? You know, is it still very early stage or is it getting some decent uptake?
Yeah, so it's early stage. And so what we're finding with a lot of our customers essentially is that they are very interested in its adoption. They just really don't know, one, because no one's processing it in South Africa. And anyone that has hemp in South Africa is currently importing it, you know. So there's a lot of room for growth in South Africa for this domestic hemp space. But also, like I say, you know, import substitution is one thing that we really look at, you know, trying to basically cut the retailers from importing any hemp material. You know, it's actually going as far in terms of the market opportunity that some of the retailers are not looking at hemp as a niche category of clothing, but kind of looking to see if they can replace a baseline level of cotton in the overall production.
So very, very much localization of supply chain, which is something we see a lot out of retailers. I mean, that is an interesting trend. Maybe this is your investment background coming through, hey? Spotting these future trends and trying to get on top of growth industries as opposed to actually getting into sunset industries. I can kind of see the overlap and how that might have been your thinking. You know, the yellow goods as a good cash flow business and then the hemp as the long-term growth play, right?
Correct. And like you said it perfectly now, Ghost. Ultimately, you know, you want to be in a position or in an industry that's kind of not really taken off yet, but you want to catch that wave up. And I feel like that's kind of where the hemp industry is now. This is some uncertainty, you know, but I mean, you gotta ride through the uncertainty, you know, to kind of see what comes out at the end, right?
Moefe, I think that's fascinating. I mean, my question was actually around textiles because that was my frame of thinking. And I think you introducing the whole industrial element to it, for example, conveyor belts, that's excellent. Because again, you know, people that aren't looking at these micro niches are not going to see the opportunity. And I mean, that's really the benefit, I guess, of coming with a formal finance background, then being able to leverage that in terms of spotting opportunities. And as Ghost has said, I mean, what you're doing on the one side is you've de-risked on the yellow goods stuff, and then you've kind of got the growth opportunities coming through in the hemp space. Very interesting. Now, I want to maybe segue from that into a look at, you know, real world business is very different from financial markets. When we sit here, we look at screens, we look at company reports. You know, quite often you've got to look at what the company reports are not telling you. They're very sanitized. And what we want to get out of this discussion, certainly on this next question I want to ask you is, what were some of those big lessons that you actually learned while operating in that space? You know, the sanitized, the glossy space, as Ghost likes to call it. And how did you then take those and effectively morph those into real-world business lessons. What are some of those real-world business lessons that you've learned? And I mean, we both know, we've been entrepreneurs, Ghost and myself as well. We know that the real business world is a lot harsher than the kind of finance world, which is very sanitized, which, you know, very processed and formalized. What were some of those things that actually stood out for you that was, you know, an absolute pleasure, just delighted you? And then also, what's kind of shocked you? What's caught you by surprise? You know, what are some of the hard lessons that you've learned operating a business on your own that you wouldn't have picked up by being a financial analyst and looking at this very sanitized view of the world?
Thanks for that, Mo. I think ultimately, my experience as a buy-side analyst, while it's a big jump from, let's say, valuation models, you know, to real-life business, there are a lot of fundamentals, or let me say a framework, that I was able to build as an equity analyst that I brought into business myself. You know, it's allowed me to basically learn a few lessons and also hone in on certain things. For one example, just a life lesson that I've learned is cash flow is king. I mean, I can't repeat it enough. It's often said, you know, in any course, finance course that you take, or any, you know, textbook that you read. But I feel like as an actual entrepreneur, you don't realize how much of a king of the castle cash is, you know, as opposed to, and this is in comparison to equity analysis, as opposed to the paper margins that you do, you know, because you find yourself in a situation as an analyst kind of building out models, and you're guided by your model. Essentially, you know, the valuations that basically come out of this model. But until you really realize the impact of cash flow timing, for example, you realize the impact that net working capital in its own has on the business. You know, profits, paper profits don't mean anything until, you know, cash is realized. And I think that also kind of speaks to kind of businesses in the listed space and why businesses that are good cash generators, as well as businesses with strong balance sheet, command a sort of premium valuation.
Speaking of models, I must thank you for giving me an opportunity here. It's going Google Mo's GQ best dressed man. I'm sorry, Mo. Back in 2014, Mo was the fourth best dressed man alongside none other than Musi Maimane, illustrious company here, Mo. And Murray Legg is a very smart guy who was a couple of years ahead of me at high school. Anyway, I do encourage our listeners to go and Google that. Sorry, Mo.
That's the wrong kind of models we're talking about. We're talking financial models.
Look,
here.
You know, like anyone who's worked in finance knows you can make the model say whatever you want. So this is not a financial model. I can't make Mo say whatever I want. Definitely not. And vice versa. But can certainly go and appreciate that time in our life, Mo. But back to serious matters. And I think we probably have time for one more question more often. I just want to, you know, really get this view from you, because I think one of the big differences when you're running money, or giving advice to people who are running money, or even just putting analysis into them as a sell side analyst, or buy side for that matter, is diversification is pretty much a feature of any portfolio. People are looking to spread their money. But I think when you're an entrepreneur, if you're overly diversified, you run a real risk of losing focus, not being on top of where your money is, and actually doing worse for diversification as opposed to doing better. So concentration risk is a feature of being an entrepreneur. And I'm just wondering what your experience has been as someone who's been around people who are very focused on diversification, and then going into your own businesses. Yes, you do have two different income streams, which is interesting. But what are your views on risk? Do you think that it's changed a bit going into this private market effectively?
Certainly. I think real-world risk is different, definitely, from analysis risk that we considered. I mean, I can give you a sort of personal example where I found myself in my yellow machinery business, you know, servicing a client, and I had a breakdown mid-contract, you know. Then obviously that has a range of effects that leads, you know, to cash flow timing and these things. And these are not some, this is not something that you consider. I mean, no amount of beta or downside volatility can prepare you for that sort of disruption, you know. And I feel like, especially in the entrepreneurship space, conviction is earned, you know, it's not really assumed. And what I mean by that essentially is that, like I was alluding to before, as an analyst, you kind of are guided by your model, and your conviction is reflected in your financial model, right? Whereas in real world analysis, conviction comes from being right on your thesis, but also putting it down practically, you know. And I think it's quite strong, and something can be said for entrepreneurs who are able to stress test their own vision and still stick by it. You know, you kind of feel a bit more detached as an analyst looking at things from, you know, the higher level. I think in terms of just risk perception that I've actually gained myself, it's been great, because now going into entrepreneurship, some of the skills that I've learned as an equity analyst have definitely given me an edge, I believe, in terms of how I do business, in terms of how I've structured businesses, in terms of how I speak to clients and, you know, various stakeholders, just understanding the jargon, you know, which is, it can be, I think, underestimated, you know, depending on who you're speaking to.
Yeah, I think it is. It's a really well-rounded experience. You learn a lot going into business. You learn how to sell. You learn how to manage these difficult situations. So well done on making the leap. And it would be interesting actually to get feedback from our listeners on how many have gone from that sort of investment angle into entrepreneurship and vice versa. People who are great entrepreneurs often come out the other side and they think of themselves as great investors. And sometimes they are, and sometimes they actually learn some really hard lessons about just how different investing is to running your own business. And often I think concentration risk is the differentiator there. So thank you, Mwafa. This has been really interesting. It's been nice to have you on the show.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, guys. I appreciate the time and looking forward to more episodes, not of myself, but of everyone else as well. So thank you guys for that.
Mwafa, thank you so much. I mean, it's been insightful. And quite often these journeys are what we learn from, because the learnings you take from being in business, the learnings from the real economy, you can actually play through into your investment journey and vice versa. I don't think it's one-way traffic. I don't think it's, I was a financial analyst, this makes me good at being a business person. I think they flow both ways. I mean, some of the best, most valuable conversations I've had have been with real business owners. And I mean, one of the frustrations, I guess, when you operate in the market is that a lot of these entrepreneurs can just generate these massively superior returns in their own businesses. You know, they're generating ROEs in the solid double digits. As a result, they don't really look at financial markets to the same degree. We know, for example, your average equity returns are around 15% per annum. Most entrepreneurs can generate that on every turn of capital that they put in their business. And so that's why it's just so interesting to look at that. And I mean, here on Magic Markets, we've covered listed markets, we've covered unlisted markets. There's a lot of activity happening in the private credit and the private equity space. And so that is why this discussion with you, Mwafa, has been really insightful. I've solidly enjoyed it. I hope our listeners have enjoyed it as well. Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for this week. That's where we're going to have to leave it. Mwafa, thanks for being on the show. For our regular listeners, go and find us on social media. It's at Magic Markets Pod, one word, at Finance Ghost and at Muhammad Nala, all on X. Or go and find us on LinkedIn. Pop us a note on there. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Until next week, same time, same place. Thanks and cheers.
Cheers, guys. Cheers.
Ciao. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not financial or investment advice. Please speak to your personal financial advisor.